Okay, folks, welcome. And when I say welcome, I mean a big welcome to Planet Porky. Planet Porky, the place where you can dispense with all your cares and troubles in these difficult times for about 45 minutes, listening to myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, rock chick writer extraordinaire Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, a very big welcome to the domain of the planet. How have you been in the last couple of days?
Well, thank you. I've been fine. And you're sounding very perky, porky today,
well, yes,
I may say.
Perky, porky. That's very kind of you. As I've just said to you, because I'm doing a bit of telly at the moment, I've had to rearrange the backdrop behind me because one thing you can't do, Leslie Ann, is let people see the wrong book. You know what I mean?
Have you seen some of these shelves?
Yeah.
Some of these MPs on television with, you know, their carefully rearranged bookshelves.
That's right.
To make us all believe that they're super clever and
yep.
reading all that stuff all the time, because we know they're not.
Yes. Well, in fact, funnily enough, you say that. I saw a survey this morning. Two things came out of it. One is that people buy books just so that when their friends come round, they think that their host is very intelligent and clever, and they haven't read that 2/3 of the books on the bookshelves that you've seen in the past week, months, haven't been read by the people who've got them. They just buy them for effect. And even more so, when people get to the age of about 45 or something, they've gone out and started to buy vinyl LP records, right, just to have them stacked up in their lounge in Islington at home when they're, you know, their mid-wealthy friends come round. And when asked, oh, that's a lovely LP from my youth, let's play it, they admit they haven't actually got any equipment to play it on.
Well, they all live in Islington, do they?
Well, it's not a lot of them live in Islington or Hornsey or North London or places like that.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
So I think there is a lot of that goes on. Don't you look rather ridiculous if you buy vinyl albums but you don't have the equipment to play them on? I mean, anybody's going to find you out that quickly.
Yeah.
I actually have a lot of vinyl. I don't buy vinyl anymore
yeah.
because I've got it all from the past. I've offloaded quite a lot each time I've moved house over the years.
Yeah.
But I've still got about 1,000 albums.
You're joking, 1,000?
No. Yeah, I've got all my dad's old record collection and I've got my own, which has been whittled down, as I say, but I've got about 1,000 left.
My God.
And I do play them, and my kids have rediscovered them recently,
really
nice.
Your kids would. I bet you must have a lot of album covers signed by a lot of very famous pop stars.
Yeah, I've got a few, yeah. It's a funny thing. We didn't really do that back in the day. We didn't ask people to sign things. That
yeah.
wasn't cool.
Yeah.
And we didn't have our picture taken with rock stars because nobody did. And
no.
Of course, nowadays, everybody has their picture taken
exactly.
with absolutely everyone.
Mm.
That when, say, a publisher, a foreign publisher, or a newspaper in New York or somebody comes on to me and says, have you got a picture of yourself with Freddie Mercury? No, I haven't.
Yeah.
Because we didn't do that kind of thing, did we, in the day?
Well,
I know that people like David Wigg
yes.
always had his picture taken with whoever he was interviewing.
And Piers Morgan, our old friend.
With Piers Morgan. I didn't do that. You didn't do that.
Well, Jim, it's funny what you should say. A, we didn't have camera phones in those days, so it wasn't as easy to whip your phone out and say picture. But you're absolutely right in what you say. I wrote Joe Cole's book when Joe Cole was one of the most famous footballers in this country. He was playing for England. He was winning championships with Chelsea and all that. And during the course of the book, and it took us about 15 months altogether, A, I never took a picture of myself with Joe, I realised at the end, right? And B, I never got a signed Joe Cole shirt, you know, which would have been great to have put in my collection of signed football shirts alongside David Beckham and Wayne Rooney and all that. And the other person in football, who's been a friend of mine now for 20 years, Mr. Kenwright, the chairman of Everton, I haven't got a single picture of Mr. Kenwright and I together.
And we should get one quick before he dies.
Well, listen, we don't like to think those things openly, but of course we're all getting on, and it would be a terrible regret to me if I didn't seal my friendship, you know. And it's a long, strong friendship, you know. We've discussed a lot of things together and a lot of issues, and it would be terrible, but you know, that's life. But you're absolutely right. I can understand. How could you possibly? You just letting yourself down, aren't you? If you relegate the relationship, which is so professional, so easygoing, and so acceptable on both sides, when you suddenly ask for an autograph.
Yeah, you suddenly reduce yourself to being a fan. Yes. And there's nothing wrong with being a fan, but in the right context. So if you're there to do a professional job, as we always have been as journalists and photographers, you know, the photographer is not going to respect the journalist who suddenly says, oh, can you get a picture of me with Mick Jagger?
I know.
It just takes it over to the other side, and it's not acceptable. I still don't think it is if you're there to work.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And yet all the time, you know, my heart, he's screaming, I must in some way get recognition with this. I found a picture. I'm doing a lot of decluttering at the moment, right?
And we're all doing that.
We're all doing that. And I'm going through files going back some 20 years, okay? Don't know why I've kept them, going through them. I found a picture of myself and Noel Gallagher at a venture called the Premier League Football Hall of Fame, which I was a patron of and in fact, kind of invested in, you know, many years ago. And Noel Gallagher was there. I never knew that picture existed, honest to God. And it's amazing. He looks so young. He looks about 16. And you forget those things. And, you know, tell you what else I found. Amazingly, I must have been head of the Press Association at the time, okay? And what happens is the Press Association, the PA, well-respected around the world, they had then a responsibility to cover all royal events that nobody else would bother going to, okay? So, you know, when people get their MBEs, OBEs, knighthoods and all that, there's always a PA reporter there. Anyway, I must have looked through the list of people who were getting awards that day, and Neville Southall, the Everton goalkeeper and the best goalkeeper in the world at the time, and this is about 96 or something like that, right, was getting his OBE or his MBE or something. It was in the list. So I must have asked the royal reporter to get him to sign the order of service. And amazingly, it says, to Mike, best wishes, Neville Southall. And again, I didn't even know I had that. And that's going in a frame on the wall now.
Well, very good. You know, there used to be a big market in autographs,
that's
didn't
right.
there? And people would sell them. Online, I think it became a different thing because suddenly there was a huge fake market in autographs.
Yeah.
They're very easy to copy, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you really think, I mean, we all had an autograph when we were a child, didn't we? We used to rush around getting people to sign, especially on the last day of school and stuff like that.
Yes, that's right.
But do you ever look at those things again? Would you ever get that autograph book from the end of school and look through that and remember even half of those people?
Well, probably not. And when you've got them on the wall, I've got signed shirts on the wall. I walk past them now without noticing them, but I've got Wayne Rooney's first England shirt, okay? And it says, best wishes, Wayne Rooney, number 23, England versus Australia, because I'm looking at it now, 12th of the 2nd, 2003. And you don't kind of notice. A friend of mine who was brought up in sort of St. John's Wood, right? I was round at his place once, and he didn't live in St. John's Wood then, and there was a mural on the wall, and it was a picture of the Beatles from about, you know, the mid-60s somewhere, and it was signed by all four Beatles. And I said, my God, I said, that would be worth a fortune. He said, it might be, but we'd never sell it. His father had worked in the newspaper industry. He was a graphic artist, and he just happened to be doing some artwork one day when, you know, they were at a Beatles event or something to do some artwork, wasn't it? And all the four Beatles signed it for him. It's on his wall at home. I mean, that must be worth a fortune, mustn't it?
Amazing. I got an email this week from a guy, we'll call him Big John because we don't want to give out his identity.
Yes.
He deals in rock memorabilia.
Wow.
And he said to me, have you got any handwritten Beatles lyrics?
Yeah.
I said, funnily enough, no. He said, if you can get any handwritten Beatles lyrics, especially John Lennon or Paul McCartney, he said, we're looking at 500 grand. For, you know, I wish I had some. But
yes, of course you do.
Again, would I sell them if I had them? I'm not sure I would.
Well, you might later. Things that are very important to you do suddenly lose their sentimental value to as you get older. My record collection, just going back very quickly, I threw it all away, you know. I was mad.
How did you do that?
I was mad when I was, I lost my job as the news editor of the Daily Express. My time had just come, done it for 6 years. I was going mad and Sir Nick Lloyd, the editor, just said, time step down. He said, why don't you go to America and do the US election campaign with a guy called Bill Clinton, who nobody had ever heard of, you know? And I was so mad and furious at this, you know, that I had to clear my house out and rent it out while I was going to be in America for a year, you know. And I threw out my record collection. I cannot believe what I did. I was just so mad and furious. I didn't care. And I remember getting them out the boot of my car and hurling them to a skip at the council tip. I can't believe I did it.
I'm bleeding at the thought. That was an awful thing to do.
Oh, I mean, you're talking about Bowie records, Queen records, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones. Fortunately, many years later, and only a few years ago now, a person who listened to TalkSport a lot, who knew I was a big Beatles fan, dealt in original Beatles records and sent me a full set of Beatles records in both mono, black and white, and stereo. And I've got them. And that's all I really wanted. So I've been very lucky, really. Anyway,
Beatles stuff is all available on CD and it's all been remastered and everything else, you know. But a lot of albums that we had in the past were never released on CD or in any other format.
No.
So some of that music is lost to us.
Yeah.
And that's the great shame of it. It's a good thing you're a Beatles fan because you can always get that.
Yeah, I totally agree. I remember one Christmas, we came down Christmas morning. My sister was a year older than me. She wanted the latest Beatles LP. It was with the Beatles. That one where the pictures of them are half in shadow, you know, on the front. And that I realise now that was 1963. And that was the start of the Beatles collection that I had because I nicked it from her years later. But, oh, my God. Anyway, my dear, we've got to talk about the issue at hand, which, of course, is lockdown and coronavirus. Are you coping well?
Yeah, we're doing really well, actually. We're fine. There are four of us in the house. Yep. So I've got all my children home.
Yep.
The two who were meant to graduate this year, that's not going to happen. But my youngest daughter has just got herself a job in China.
Wow.
Teaching English from September, October, depending on when all this is open again.
Yeah, fantastic.
Because they have said, haven't they, that we might not be flying long haul again until 2023, which is quite a long time to wait. So I'm hoping for her sake that airspace is open again so that she can get there. So she's been doing a lot of planning. My son studied Mandarin at Dulwich College, so he's been helping her with translation, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
My other daughter works for Island Records, so she's very busy doing her normal job.
That's right.
And I can, of course, work from wherever I am. I could work from the top of a mountain with a laptop, you know. My life hasn't changed that much, to be honest.
No, well, that's great. You can bet that that job in China will happen because they can't close down all the airlines altogether because so much cargo comes around the world in aeroplanes. So aeroplanes will always fly, but they might not have passengers on them. But I bet you the first international country that says we're open for business will be China. And here in Britain, we don't have any option but to allow Chinese planes to come into the country and go out again. And they will get their act together, China, and say, no, we're completely clear now. You can fly to China.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. Yeah. And I hope for her sake that it happens.
I'm sure. Now, that brings me to
really tough on the kids, by the way, because, you know, there are millions of kids around the country and all over the world, I'm sure, who don't get to graduate this year after all the years of toil.
Yes.
And, quite a lot of partying as well going on the side, we know.
Yeah.
But it's the big build-up, isn't it, to that graduation ceremony. And now they're not going to have it. And I feel really sorry for them for that.
No, I do as well. I mean, we've all had problems in our lives, but perhaps not one quite as big as this. We've never fought a war. Our parents did, or at least my parents did. Yours will have done. So, you know, we have to be thankful for the fact that we've had a rather peaceful life. Now we've got to cope with this. Now, something I've got to cope with in this lockdown, Leslie Ann, is my roof garden. And I'm getting pretty upset because always the first weekend after Easter, my housekeeping lady, who does everything for me here, she goes off down to the garden centre and she gets a load of plants, comes back and she completely goes through the garden. She throws out all the stuff from last year, all the winter plants, the hanging baskets and all that, and reboots everything. And by now, after a month of seed and all that, it would look like Kew Gardens, honestly. But the problem is, because it's all so shattered, the birds have come along and they've, you know, plants now come out of like what I would call tea bags. You know, they don't come out of the soil. You plant these tea bags in soil and the flowers grow out of them. And they've picked all those out and scattered them around. Unfortunately, do you remember we had a series of gales just before the coronavirus epidemic?
Oh, yeah, we
really
did. That was
storm.
That heralded the infection, maybe.
But might have done. But that has blown down two of my big panel fences. in the roof garden, which will have to be replaced. They can't be repaired. They've been you know, pretty badly smashed. So they're boarded up at the moment. So I've got to find a fence company who will come and do that. So things in the Porky roof garden not looking good. I want to get going, and that's why I want a speedy resolution and a return to work, which of course has started this very week.
Well, it has. I'm really worried about it. You know I am.
Yes.
I fully expect a second wave of this infection. I think the second wave will be infinitely more deadly than the first. Mm. And I think everybody's just got bored. They want life to get back to normal as quickly as possible. I understand that. But let's not be too hasty. I'm really particularly worried about schools going back. Mm. I think schools don't need to go back now until September. Let's just allow the children, because we're now finding out, are we not, that children are carrying this new variation on the theme of the infection.
Yep.
And they can also infect teachers, and they can take the virus home to their parents.
Yep.
So I think it's a bad idea to unlock schools for now.
Well, my counter-argument to that would be that only one child under the age of 10, mercifully, has died in this country during the whole of the pandemic, and that's because children are largely unaffected by it. The little,
but I'm not talking about their safety. I'm talking about their teachers and the families of the teachers and the parents.
Yeah, I agree. But surely, you know, even if you pare classes down to 15 in a room with one teacher, that teacher can self-isolate herself or himself, work from the other side of a glass partition, or put a suit on to protect itself from the virus that the children might be carrying but won't actually suffer from. And when they get home, again, it's up to the parents to wash their hands before they come through the door and to take their clothes off and to put them in the washing machine. I know it's a pain, you know, to have to go through that every day, but I really do think children need social gatherings and social get-togethers, because they're going to be having mental health problems like all the rest of us.
I agree with that. But what about children being carriers of the disease?
Well,
they can bring it into school and they can pass it around to other kids, because kids will rough and tumble. They will play.
Yeah.
They'll fall all over each other, and then they can all take it home. I think it's too soon for me, Mike. You know how I feel about this.
But I don't think there's ever going to be a right time, you see, because supposing we never find a vaccine for COVID-19. When are you going to say, okay, well, we've got to try and return to normal now? This could go on forever. So,
I've heard this week.
We have to make a political decision.
I agree. They've said, haven't they, whoever they are this week, that it could take 5 years to conquer the virus.
Yes, exactly.
I wonder whether there will ever be a vaccine, because it's mutating so fast.
Exactly, I agree. By the time we get a vaccine for this one, there'll be another one somewhere. But look, it's the world we live in, and we all have to face up to it. Now, Leslie-Ann, I want to ask you, have you ever heard of a lady called Melanie Blake?
Oh, yeah. Now, this looks like it was like the times were taken.
Yeah.
Because there was a big outcry on Facebook this week.
Was there?
With a lot of people who used to work at Top of the Pops.
Right. There's a serialization, just to explain to our listeners, the Time magazine serialized an extract, allegedly, from this lady's book. She claims she was at the top of the pop business and told salacious stories about pop stars.
Yeah, well, all the guys on Facebook who used to work for Top of the Pops, none of them can remember her. They're all asking the question, do you remember this Melanie Blake? Who is she? Now, the other thing to ask, to be very suspicious about, is that this woman is only 49.
Yeah, that's right,
Which suggests
42.
That she would have...
42.
42, okay, I even got that wrong.
But... Melanie Blake, who describes herself as a multimillionaire music manager, has turned novelist and is writing books based on what she says is the truth.
Well, I think that they've been had. And so does everybody else who's involved. Nobody can remember her. Who's heard of Melanie Blake? I never had. And neither did anyone at Top of the Pops.
No. You see, when I first saw her name, Melanie Blake, I thought, oh, well, that could be John's sister. But of course, John's in his mid-60s at least, isn't he?
Oh, John's quite a lot older than that.
That's right. Okay, in his 70s. There you go. So this woman, 42. But I mean, I'll just outline to you some of the stories she tells. She says Robbie Williams, who was still in Take That, was a right pain in the arse. He thought he could do whatever he wanted, including kicking footballs against studio soundproof doors. When I asked him to stop, he threatened to get me fired. He was such a dick. He was at the height of his fame and arrogance. I've heard he's nothing like that now, but the boy bands were just big children, really, setting off fire alarms all over the place and breaking out the fire extinguishers.
Well, anybody could have made that up, couldn't they?
Yeah, I mean, they could have done. Because, yeah. Actually, I remember Take That coming into the offices of the newspaper I was working for, and they were a bit like that, but they weren't horrible. They were just cheeky. They stole all the fruit from the editor's bowl of fruit and went round jumping up and down on desks and that sort of thing. And we had a full-size model of Mr. Blobby. Do you remember Mr. Blobby from the Noel Edmonds
I
show?
Do.
You had a full-size model of him in the newsroom. They started kicking him around and all that. They were good fun, actually. But not obnoxious. So
I don't think she's genuine, this woman. I think that, well, somebody did actually say on Facebook this week, I think the times have been had.
Oh.
And I have to say, I think I agree.
Really? Well, that's amazing. It says at the end, it's accredited to The Thunder Girls by Melanie Blake, is published by Pan Macmillan as a special edition book. That in itself is a strange explanation, isn't it?
Yeah, what is a special edition book?
I have no idea what a special edition book is.
It's all a bit April Fool's, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. She says here about Jerry Halliwell, and perhaps we're being unkind reading this if it's all fictitious, but she says Jerry Halliwell, of course, the lead singer of the Spice Girls, Ginger Spice. She says,
well, they were all lead singers, weren't they?
Equal
lead singers, I think, the five of them, yeah.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're absolutely right. They all... I think that was the war, wasn't it, between Jerry Halliwell and Mel B? Yeah, Mel B.
Well, the war was that Melanie B said that they'd had an affair.
Oh, yeah.
And Jerry said, oh, no, we didn't. And then, of course, Mel goes into detail.
Yeah, that's right.
I suspect that there was a little fiddling going on there.
Oh, dear. Well, I think, you know, this is a family podcast, so we better gloss over that. So she says of Jerry Halliwell is a joke. She should be embarrassed of herself. Everybody loved her because she had very little talent, but an awful lot of charisma and determination. But then the delusions of grandeur happened. First it's posh boys, then it's the clothes, then her boobs were shrunk and she became stick thin. Then it's all about United Nations ambassador. You know what? When she had a big bust and was from Watford, people loved her. She proved herself. She made it from nowhere. That's to be applauded. Now she sounds like she's straight out of Buckingham Palace, the cast. So whether Ms. Blake is actually... There's a picture of her as well, sitting by a swimming pool and all that. So
see, that know, doesn't look that, like PR, does it? That looks like a Hollywood kind of starlet, that picture.
Yeah, it does.
She doesn't actually look like your average PR.
She doesn't look like your average PR. She doesn't look like an author. And she doesn't look careworn enough to have worked in our industry for, you know, if she's 42 now, 20 years.
All the PRs, we know all the PRs.
Yeah,
we do. All the guys and gals who've worked in the rock industry all these years, we know them all.
We do.
Where was this woman?
I don't know. And as you quite rightly pointed out, she's so young. You know, how could she have worked with them all at that age?
Exactly.
Anyway, there we go. Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the wonderful Leslie and Jones. And, you know, we've got over a few of the tough subjects. That's coronavirus and what you do with your books and your paintings. One thing I did want to talk to you about, Leslie Ann, was Michelle Obama, right? Now, I know to an awful lot of people in this world, particularly female, Michelle Obama is an absolute hero. A Netflix documentary has been made. It's it was filmed during the former First Lady's book tour. And the guy who's written it, and again, funnily enough, this is a piece from The Times, Kevin Maher, says she's an extraordinary woman. Did you get that impression?
Well, I think she's a bit oversold, to be honest. You know, her
yeah,
book,
I think that, yeah.
She had a huge success with the book. It was number one bestseller list all over the world for months and months, wasn't it? And she does have great charisma, Michelle Obama, but she was not the president.
Yeah.
I think we've gone a bit over the top about first ladies in general. You know, we're rather suspicious of that concept here because, of course, we have a constitutional monarchy. Our monarch is the head of state. The president in the United States is the closest thing they have to a monarch.
Yes.
And therefore, their consort is, of course, of interest.
Yes.
So we had Jackie O, didn't we? Jackie Kennedy, as she was when she was married to John F. Kennedy, the president.
Yes.
She was a style icon. She was a very rich woman
yes.
in her own right. She came from a wealthy
Jacqueline
family.
Bouvier.
That's it. And she also had a great sort of stylish presence about her. She was probably the first. And a lot of people modeled themselves on her. With Melania, I think there's not a lot going on there, is there really?
Well, actually, that's a bit unkind. I was going to ask you about Melania, as I call her. But when you say there's not a lot going on, what do you mean?
Well, when does she ever really address the nation?
Well, she's not supposed to. You just pointed out that Michelle Obama wasn't the president.
Yeah, I know. But don't you remember the speech that she made when Trump was first sworn in?
Yeah.
And she gave a speech which it was later exposed as virtually a copy of a speech that Michelle Obama had given herself. Michelle was in the habit of giving speeches, if you remember.
Yes, she was. Yeah.
So, you know, I think First Lady doesn't mean anything here because, you know, Prime Minister's only in for a few years and they're not the head of state anyway. So it's a whole different thing.
Yes.
And I think in recent years we've had a few, haven't we? Cherie Blair, for example.
Yeah.
I think she liked to think there was something very stately about her.
Yeah.
But of course there wasn't. And who cares about her now?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. We've always had a First Lady and the Queen anyway. So,
of course we have. Well, and long may she reign.
Yeah, exactly. I totally agree. I quite like Melania because she doesn't get involved. You know, I mean, I said in the first part of this podcast, I went on the road with Bill Clinton. And, of course, that included Hillary. And, I mean, Hillary was a nightmare. Hillary was often running things ahead of Bill. And I said very, very early on, first of all, I said, I think Bill Clinton's going to win the election. And everybody in London laughed and said, don't be ridiculous. George Bush has won the war in the Middle East. He's got, you know, 90% approval ratings. I said, yeah, but he's not even going out and campaigning because he doesn't think there's anybody to campaign against. And then the economy tanked for the last 6 months of the election campaign. Bill Clinton got in. But my God, the influence that Hillary had on everything. And I said to the guys then, I said, I'll tell you what's going to happen here. I said, Bill Clinton will get two terms in office. I said, and then Hillary will take over. And of course, she very nearly did.
Well, don't you think that was all part of the master plan?
Yes.
That it was her idea to big him up and
yes.
get him into the White House to pave the way for her own campaign and huge success,
yeah.
which, of course, backfired horribly, didn't it?
Well, it did in the end, but only, you know, by a handful of votes. She actually got more Americans to vote for her, but because of the college system, Donald Trump got there. You know, he got the electoral college votes. But you're absolutely right. The idea of having a woman president in those days was absurd, so Bill had to go first. There's this famous joke, isn't there, when Bill and Hillary are in the back of the limo and they're heading back from Washington down to Arkansas, the poorest state in the Union, and they stop for gas. And they, you know, the guy is pumping gas into their car and Bill turns to Hillary and says, just think, Hillary, if you hadn't met me, you could have ended up with a guy who was pumping gas into our limousine. And she said, if I'd have ended up with him, Bill, he'd have been the president, not you. That's how influential she was,
exactly.
You know. And how she, you know, she put her imprimatur on the presidency from very, very early on. And by the way, they had the most open marriage you can imagine. When I was down in Arkansas, you'd talk to some of the guys who used to protect Bill Clinton. I mean, it's called the Home Guard. It's supposed to be a public body. It wasn't. It was Bill's private army. And a lot of these guys' jobs was just to provide women, any women, for Bill Clinton at political meetings. And Hillary knew all about it. It was part of the deal, you know?
It does seem to be a feature of men in power that they have terribly, terribly high sex drives
yes.
that have to be serviced
yeah.
so that they can perform according to the role that they've been thrust into. Pardon the pun.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know what you mean. But is that necessarily a bad thing? I don't know. Funnily enough, I was reading...
What, using women for sexual purposes is not a bad thing?
Well, no, but women are attracted to powerful men. This is what I've never understood. I've never understood when you see a very rich guy and he has a girl on his arm who's 30 years younger, people say in amazement, oh, she only wants him for his money. My view is she's attracted to the way that guy made his money, i.e. he's got character, personality, drive, ambition, he's highly intelligent. All those things must count, mustn't they?
Well, of course they do, but that's fine when it's a relationship.
Yeah.
But if it's just a one-night stand or a string of one-night stands,
yeah.
those women are being used as machines.
Yeah, well, of course I could say that's their personal choice. But then I'd be accused of being sexist, and I'm not being sexist. What I'm saying is I think people have to weigh up the set of cards they were dealt or the hand of cards they were dealt in life and try and play them as best they can. Listen, I'll tell you what I want to talk to you about. I saw this fantastic feature this week because all sorts of consequences of lockdown. How about this for a great feature? No sex, no hookups, c'est bien. That's French, by the way. That's my French.
I recognize that.
Why single French women love la crise? Because that's what lockdown's called in France, la crise. And then you turn the page and it says, French single women were supposed to be miserable on their own. Instead, they are thrilled to get a break from the pressure to hook up and are enjoying life more than ever in a lockdown Paris. What do you think about that?
Well, it's a poor excuse for a feature, isn't it, really? We've got psychologists predicting loneliness and depression without the habitual one-night stand.
Yeah.
I don't think that there's a habitual one-night stand among all single French women. I think, you know, it's probably a feature of single life around the world.
Yes.
It's just because there is a cliche about French people being more into sex than anybody else in the world.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's getting a little bit of time off. Single women servicing blokes, you know, big yawn.
Yeah.
Nobody really wants that. All French single girls want is what women all over the world want, which is a committed, loving relationship. And all those boring one-night stands are just trying to find the one. That's all that's about. So, of course, they're very happy to have some time off from that.
Yeah,
who wouldn't be?
And apparently it's created a huge surge in phone sex, right? Which I personally have never understood. It must be of an age or something like that. But, you know, the idea of getting onto a phone and start mumbling down a phone, things that you should really only ever say in the intimacy of a private room with somebody. I just don't get that. I've never got it.
It's a bit gross, isn't it? I mean, it's a bit like porn, isn't it, I suppose? But look, I mean, I've always thought that sex without love was a bit pointless. And you want your sex to be in a loving relationship with one other person. So maybe we're discovering things in general about ourselves, about, you know, the human personality, about our own personalities, and what we really want out of life. And maybe we'll all be going looking in different directions for the things we really want after this is all over.
No, you could well be right. I have always had enormous sympathy for mistresses. I really have. And sometimes...
Well, you've had a few.
I meant mistresses who were married to... who were the mistress to a married man, okay? I've always felt incredibly sorry for them because they were in such a no-win situation. I went out with a girl once and she had been the mistress of a very successful and established sports reporter in Fleet Street who will have been very well known to your father, who was a leading light of the Fleet Street sports glitterati, you know? And she went out with this guy for 3 years, worked in the same office every day. He told her he was going to leave his wife. And, of course, he had a lovely, comfortable house in the home counties, you know, four-bedroom detached on a nice estate. And she was a divorcee. And she lived in a council flat in Bermondsey, okay? And, you know, they'd done what they could to make it nice for her family. Her family were a very basic family. Her father was a lift engineer. But every day, you know, when she, you know, twice a week met up with, you know, her boyfriend and they went out for lunch and then a bit of refreshment in the afternoons and all this kind of stuff. And they used to take her away on overseas trips that we've talked about before when he was covering football matches and all that, right? And in the end, you know, she had to give him the ultimatum. But the saddest moment was when she told me that on the second Christmas, her dad and her mum and her got into her dad's lift engineer's van, right, a white van, and they drove down to his house and drove up and down his street three times just to peer through the window and see the domestic bliss he was living in on Christmas Day with a twinkling Christmas tree and his children opening their presents and all that. And I felt very sorry for somebody who's in that situation.
Well, who would do that for a start? What a terrible thing to do.
Well, yeah, but doesn't it indicate a state of mind that you feel...
Well, yeah, but your mum and dad come with you and go and visit, your secret lover and try and spy on the wife and kids.
Yes.
I think there's something a bit damaged about that, isn't there? Look, the bottom line is he is not going to leave his wife.
Never.
Hardly any of them ever leave their wives.
No, never.
They just want a bit on the side. And then when they get found out, which 9 times out of 10 they do, they usually beg forgiveness of her indoors because they don't want their life to be disrupted.
No, they don't.
They don't want to give up their house.
I totally agree.
It's private schools and the cars and the second home and all of that. They don't want to have to compromise all that. They just want a bit of fun on the side.
They do.
Sorry, girls, but that's all it's about.
I totally agree. And I don't know when women are going to understand that. You know, there's so many examples of that sort of thing happening. In fact, of course, you and I had a mutual friend, who became a pretty successful sort of mid-ranking executive in Fleet Street, who had...
I know exactly who you're talking about.
Exactly. Yeah. Who had a boyfriend for 20 years, but who never said he would leave his wife, did he?
Yeah, but when she died, he was devastated.
I know
he was beyond devastated and said, he was full of remorse, that he should have done something about the relationship much sooner.
Yeah.
He should have left his wife. And the weird thing was his wife knew about it.
Yes.
And put up with it. She just turned a blind eye. And I think lots of them do, because lots of these women actually don't want to have sex with their husbands anymore.
Yeah.
They get bored with it.
Yeah.
And from the other side, the mistress says, well, look, I don't have to wash his pants and socks.
That's right.
I get the good side of him. I get the romantic dinners. Yeah. I get the little holidays away. I get it all sort of glamorous and gorgeous. And I don't have to deal with the nitty gritty.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Paul McCartney's first solo single, Every Day She Takes a Morning Bath, She Wets Her Hair. That was about a mistress, wasn't it?
Another day, yeah. It's just another day.
Just another day.
Yeah, mistresses. I mean, God, it's
such
a cliche, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's part of the kind of modern world. Now, talking about that, not necessarily mistresses, but he had a few of them. I saw a fantastic programme on Peter Sellers just this week, okay?
Oh, you've got a good Peter Sellers story.
A terrific Peter Sellers story. And, of course, the minute it came on. Now, this Peter Sellers story, it's all about, the wives he had, Britt Ekland, Lynn Frederick, some young lady when he was very young, whose name I can't remember. But the point at which the story leapt out of the TV screen and in front of me was he had his final heart attack when he was about 54, and he was in the Middlesex Hospital in London, which is up near Euston Station. Do you know where it is?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, that's right, beyond Bloomsbury Square there, And anyway, I'd only just arrived in London as a reporter on the Daily Express, and a chap called Roger Taverner was a reporter on the Press Association, okay? And we got on very well together because we were all about the same age, all very ambitious to get on in life and all that kind of stuff. So we concocted this plot, and we somehow got into the Middlesex Hospital, which was ringed by security, whatever security was in those days, because Peter Sellers was in a private ward somewhere high up in the building, 8th or 10th floor, and he was critically ill. And Spike Milligan had already come out, and Spike Milligan was very eccentric and said, oh, Peter's fine. He just sat up and I spoke to him, had a long chat. He's going to be fine. I'd imagine he'll be out in a couple of days. It was complete nonsense. Spike Milligan must have been talking to somebody else because Peter Sellers was in a coma. But with that, Mr. Taver and I decided to get in the hospital. We found two white gowns, and we actually did, the classic deception of getting in the lift, pretending to be hospital staff, got right up to the cellar's floor, got right to the door of his private room. And that was the first time we were challenged. And we half got in, and there was a glass screen between us and Peter Sellers. But it was quite obvious he couldn't have spoke to anybody. He had so many tubes in his mouth and his face and his lungs. And about 6 hours later, he died. But
you got the exclusive last ever interview, didn't you?
I did. I got the last exclusive interview with him. And also I got the last exclusive interview with the famous ballet dancer who died of AIDS in St. Martin's in the Caribbean, because I happened to be there.
Oh, Nureyev, you mean?
Nureyev, yeah. I got into his bedroom before he died, climbed over the back wall of his villa on St. Bart's.
And it's all very end of pier, isn't it?
We all did it, end of pier. You say that with great disapproval in your voice, Leslie.
No, not at all. I did my fair share of it. I've dressed up as a nurse.
Yeah.
I dressed up as a London zookeeper.
Don't tell people that after we've talked about mistresses. Please, Leslie.
Well, exactly.
A family show.
Yeah, sorry. I dressed up as a London zookeeper once, and we rented a monkey from London Zoo to infiltrate the Dorchester Hotel where Michael Jackson was staying.
Wow.
With Bubbles the chimp on the top floor.
Yeah.
And similar to you, we managed to get in the lift and all the way to the penthouse before security decided that we weren't for real and had us ejected. But we were going on a little play date with a rented monkey and Bubbles the chimp.
Well, that's fantastic. And do you know
what?
So
we still had a story. We managed to write all of that, you know. So you always had a story.
Oh, I wrote a fantastic talk with Peter Sellers because I was around the people. I was listening to the people around his bedside talking about what they were talking about that they'd talk to him about, you know what I mean? When he was first brought in, before he went into this coma and all that kind of stuff. And Nureyev did actually speak to me, but I didn't know who he was talking to. But anyway, that's by the by.
There's a whole series in that, Famous Last Words.
Famous Last Words, indeed. A friend of mine didn't have such good luck. He was a reporter on the Evening Standard in London, and he was known as the Animal because he was a Scotsman, a big, burly Scotsman, very rough and ready. Adamson, I think his name was. I can't quite remember.
I remember the Animal. I don't remember his real name.
Yeah, you remember the Animal? Yeah,
I do.
He had a big moustache and he was a big, burly guy. I remember his name when we finished recording this because, you know, we had a lot of sort of capers together in Fleet Street and whatever. But he was, in those days, the Evening Standard and the Evening News regarded themselves as national newspapers, really, you know, in the capital, as you know, because you worked in the same street as them. And so his newspaper sent him north during the miners' strike to infiltrate Arthur Scargill's inner sanctum. You know what I mean? So he put a donkey jacket on and a flat cap and he went up
donkey
there.
Donkey jacket.
Sorry?
Donkey jacket.
Yeah, donkey jacket.
That is a phrase in my family. I don't know why.
Oh, is it? Yeah. A donkey jacket. Yeah.
A donkey jacket.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. And he got up there and they were at some mine, you know, location, some pit or something, you know, some riot going on or something. And old Colin Adamson, that was his name, Colin Adamson, the Animal.
Yes.
You know, yeah. And he was standing at Scargill's shoulder when a passing journalist from the Daily Telegraph or something, you know, suddenly shouted over, "Hey, Col, how you doing, son? You know, what are you doing in there? You know, you got yourself a scoop?" Or something like that. And of course, all these burly Yorkshiremen who were Arthur Scargill's Praetorian Guard turned on and said, "What?" And they started searching through his pockets and everything, you know, found out he wasn't around. So they picked him up and they literally ran him down the road and threw him over a brick wall into a ditch on the other side. And he never ever went undercover again. Because
he probably never recovered from that.
No, he thought he was going to be killed. But, you know, that's one of those things. But Sellers was a weirdo, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. You know, I've got a lovely friend. Do you remember Françoise Pascal? She was a famous actress in the 70s.
Yes.
She had a long relationship with Peter Sellers.
Oh.
She was, in fact, his mistress, yeah, for a while.
Wow.
Yeah, but it's a funny thing, this kind of glazed eyes look that comes over all these women who were ever involved with him. I could never see the attraction.
Yeah. Well,
he wasn't a good-looking guy. I didn't particularly enjoy his humour.
No.
Maybe I was too young to understand it. I don't know. But, you know, what did they see in him?
I don't know. I watched that documentary all the way through. I thought the same as you. He had those sort of Eric Morecambe-type glasses. He wasn't terribly good-looking. He was rather introvert. You know, there's this expression, isn't there, all the time, that, oh, a man can laugh a woman into bed. You know what I mean? I didn't think he was very funny at all.
Funny. And also you have that sort of Mr. Bean quality about him.
Yes.
You know, slightly sort of nerdy and weird.
Yes,
and
I agree. Well,
maybe that's what certain types of women like, that they want to protect somebody that.
You could well be right. But anyway, in light of this documentary that I saw on TV, I read one of the reviews of it the next day, and some, you know, veteran TV critic told of the story, his favourite story about Peter Sellers. Peter Sellers was so you know, nervous about his own position. He was paranoid that anybody would be more famous than him and all this kind of stuff, you know. And so, and he became friends with Princess Margaret, who was, of course, you know, legendary heavy boozer. You've been to her island and all that kind of stuff. But he was making a film at somewhere like Elstree or something like that, you know, some great British cinema location. And he got Princess Margaret to come along. He wanted to impress the whole of the crew and the production, everybody, you know. So she came along, got out of the car, and he stood there and pretended to raise a trumpet to his mouth and play a fanfare, you know, like that, you know. She walked straight past him because one of the other famous actors on the set was Orson Welles, who was her hero. So she walked straight past Peter Sellers making this mimicry, ridiculous tribute to the, you know, the Queen's sister, and embraced Orson Welles. Oh, Orson, so lovely to see you again, you know. And Sellers went completely mad and stormed off the set and stormed into the, you know, the producer's office, demanded that Orson Welles must be sacked and thrown off the film. And people like Peter Sellers live their lives like that, don't they?
Well, he was obviously weird, unhinged in some way.
Off his rocker, yeah.
You know, but Princess Margaret put it around. We know that.
Oh, yeah.
She probably had Ugandan discussions with Orson Welles.
Maybe, yeah, maybe. Who knows? Right, well, unfortunately, Leslie-Ann, time has run out, and this time goes so quickly when you and I are ruminating.
When we're enjoying ourselves.
When we're enjoying ourselves. It is lockdown, of course, and who knows what's going to happen next. But as always, terrific to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed for your time. I want to thank the audience for tuning in. The audience can get me at MikeParry8 and Leslie-Ann. They'd like to pass on their best to you, and they have been passing on their best to both of us, thank you. Where would they get you?
Oh, on Twitter at LAJWriter.
That's right. Or you can get us at planetporkypod@gmail.com. Everybody, thank you very much for listening. We will be back with you next week. Goodbye for now.
Bye now.
He got up there and they were at some mine, you know, location, some pit or something, you know, some riot going on or something. And old Colin Adamson, that was his name, Colin Adamson, the animal.
Yes.
You know, yeah. And he was standing at Scargill's shoulder when a passing journalist from the Daily Telegraph or something, you know, suddenly shouted over, "Hey, Carl, how you doing, son? You know, what are you doing in there? You know, you got yourself a scoop?" Or something like that. And, of course, all these burly Yorkshiremen who were Arthur Scargill's Praetorian Guard turned on and said, "What?" And they started searching through his pockets and everything, you know, found out he wasn't around. So they picked him up and they literally ran him down the road and threw him over a brick wall into a ditch on the other side. And he never ever went undercover again. I got into his bedroom before he died, climbed over the back wall of his villa on St. Bart's.
And it's all very end of pier, isn't it? We all did
it. You say that with great disapproval in your voice.
No, not at all. I did my fair share of it. I've dressed up as a nurse.
Yeah.
I dressed up as a London zookeeper.
That after we've talked about businesses. Please, Leslie.
Well, exactly.
A family show.
Yeah, sorry.
I have always had enormous sympathy for mistresses. I really have. And sometimes...
Well, you've had a few.